This is tape number 5 of Goblin Hunt Satyricon, copyright 1995 by James Viotti, read by Goblin Hunt, and I believe this tape commences somewhere in the middle of chapter 22, I think. So, starting here. So anyway, I guess I'd better just get on with this here little tale of woe before the squirrels start busting up the furniture or something. Maybe they've been breeding with those hardy or foolhardy desert mice out yonder in the southwest. The ones who go dashing out to beat scorpions up and have them for dinner. Not many of us could stomach that. And me? I wouldn't even invite a scorpion into my house. Much less have it for dinner. Most people wouldn't. One guy who probably would have, though, by reputation anyway, was the Marquis de Sade. Anybody remember him as the basis of this whole St. Cloud digression, perchance? De Sade would probably have palled around with scorpions and then some, especially if it ran counter to the standards and mores of his day. And he may have done just that, for all we know, in his more private moments. For all we know, he may have stuck the poisonous little bastards up his ass, and even enjoyed it and clamored for more. Hell, who knows? We do know this much about de Sade. He made it into the collective consciousness. Like him or hate him, one can only admit that de Sade's name means something. He gave his name to a form of sex that nobody understood better than he did. He added a concept to a branch of thought that most of us don't even think about or get pretty breathless about or outright slobber over or claim not to be interested in or whatever. But sex is a realm of human experience which will never become truly irrelevant or ignored, not just according to the Freudians either. Hell, fuck the Freudians. Just look at the Bible sometime. So it's a good way to be remembered, this adding to people's sexual vocabulary, or a sure way, at any rate. But there was plenty of sadism around before de Sade showed up, much of which isn't even overtly sexual. The lust to indulge in cruelty is as old as the hills. Hell, just look at the Bible sometime, or at anything in the history of power. No, all de Sade did was to start codifying it for us, to make us recognize and want to explain the fact that hurting others could cause one's penis to spurt jism or one's clitoris to become all lathered up or whatever. And that could somehow be regarded as useful information, you know, in some cases, even if that info doesn't exactly stop some raging psycho from gouging your eyes out and stomping them into jelly one by one while they're still connected to your brain, or frying your tits or your testicles and making you eat them, or just shoving a cattle prod or a soldering iron up your helpless, quivering butt and then just casually turning that little son of a bitch on. Thanks to de Sade, at least, under those trying circumstances, you can know a bit more about what's happening and why. Like Lovecraft, de Sade pointed the way to a world around us that we hadn't given much consideration to, or even, in many cases, noticed. He gave us his name as a descriptive word, and words are power. So when they're doing your orbs or your gonads or your poop shoot, like I said, don't just call them motherfuckers. Hell no. Live a little. Splurge and call them sadistic motherfuckers. What's there to lose at that point? I mention all this because it could explain St. Cloud's motivation for writing about this kind of crap. For all his frequent wide-eyed yelping and bleating about helping others and expanding the horizons of human knowledge and whatever, it's quite possible that the poor fruitcake just wanted to be remembered for what he probably thought of as St. Cloudism. Yet his sexual activities, statistically, probably couldn't have been all that unique to him. Only his motivations might have been, and who knows for sure just what anyone's true motives are. As it happens, though, I do know St. Cloud's motives in his own words, in his own handwriting, and I have reason to believe that he was telling the truth, considering the way he tortured the info out of himself to begin with. And any understanding of St. Cloud's motives for anything would be incomplete without another word fairly recently contributed to human knowledge, currently enjoying a cushy berth in even small dictionaries. Quixotic, a fictional name this time, but its creator is always waiting around in the wings to define it for us, or to epitomize it for us, as Miguel Cervantes seems in many ways to have done. Personally, I like this word a lot. It goes much further than sadism, representing a whole range of human foibles which otherwise couldn't be comprehended at all. But I don't really know if sex can truly be considered quixotic, unless nature itself can be guilty of quixotic behavior. Because all sex, unnatural or otherwise, begins and ends with nature, or it isn't really sex. As it happens, there's no faking the real thing, at least in terms of the person feeling it. If there ever is, you can sign me up for a lifetime supply. But what is sex, really? How does it really work? When any built-in reproductive considerations are set aside, all too regretfully, of course, what exactly motivates those sperm cells to line up for the ride of their lives? What exactly causes whatever kind of response it actually is that women call an orgasm? I don't mean what's going on physiologically. I don't even mean how does it feel. I mean, what triggers it and why? The answer to that can get downright subjective and often even unthinkable. Child molesters, for example, aren't doing it just to be evil, no matter what Desaad said. And they're certainly not just trying to be quixotic. Beyond whatever payback to the world they may be trying to accomplish, consciously or otherwise, their motives would be pretty simple. After the first time, it makes them come, and like most of us, they want to come, and unlike most of us, they have to be what most of us think of as evil in order to accomplish it. And what motivated St. Cloud, apart from thinking that it might help him stop bedwetting that first time, that is? It seems clear that the purest sexual motives would be associated with masturbation, aside from built-in reproductive motives, etc. Otherwise, why masturbate at all? One certainly isn't doing it for the benefit of the other person when one is alone, nor can there be any question of faking orgasm at such times. No, if the motives underlying sexual behavior can ever be considered pure, or at least accurate, it would be during such times that sexual activity goes on even when nobody else is around. A pretty common state for a recluse like St. Cloud. And so, what were his motives, or rather, what thoughts stimulated a sexual response in him? In his early days of puberty, the motives must have had to do with both voyeurism and exhibitionism. He'd masturbate to the thought of naked women, but also to the thought of being watched masturbating by fully dressed and usually glamorous women, especially ones that he'd seen in movies or on TV, most of whom, in his fantasies, regarded him, much to his perverse titillation, as childish and undeveloped, and all of whom, in his fantasies, were as amazed as he pretty much always was when he came. Eventually, St. Cloud went on to other stimuli, and by his middle age, he allowed the stimuli to become very convoluted indeed, and very quixotic, if orgasmic stimuli, an impersonal force, as it were, can ever be accused of such motivation. Nor would such an accusation truly smack of animism or the pathetic fallacy, or of any other scientific label for the mistake of attributing willful behavior to inanimate objects or impersonal forces. Whatever originates in the human subconscious, our entire perceived universe, for example, apart from our conscious focus upon it at any given time, is ipso facto contaminated by human sentience. Hence, our subconscious motivations have as much chance of being quixotic as our conscious ones have, being tarred with the same brush, as it were. We turn on, at some point, to what we're allowed to turn on to, and it very often coincides with what we consciously want to turn on to in some ways, which would sort of put child molesters back on the hook. Thank God, or hell, we'll just put them back on anyway, and then we'll throw the hook away. Was St. Cloud molested as a child? Yes and no, and maybe. Yes, some molestation went on, much of it at the hands of an insane female relative, an adult authority figure, not his mother, by the way. No, only in that young St. Cloud went along with it, more or less gladly. But he was quite young, just hitting puberty at the time. And maybe in that he suspected most of the iceberg under question to be subject to a heavy iron curtain of occlusion. And jolly old St. Cloud never quite achieved glasnost on that one, comrades. Or he hadn't, anyway, by the time he started writing his novel. He could only speculate on the roots of his anomalous conduct, which any of us could do, I suppose, given the nature of the conduct itself. But before I can dissect his conduct, I have to explain the biggest anomaly of all, if that's what it is, I have to explain the way St. Cloud's mind worked, at least in regards to his imagination, particularly as he got older. This might be anomalous or it might be the norm. It's hard to tell, and especially for me, since I share this trait with him as it happens. I call this the plausibility syndrome, and I can best explain my own case of it by reprising the events which led up to the hypothetical existence of St. Castle Bravo Cloud in the previous chapter of this story. Generally speaking, though, a sexual fantasy, that of being watched jacking off by glamorous women, for instance, is just a very functional kind of daydream, right? Which establishes that daydreaming can be functional. The fact is that even thinking about home and comfort in the midst of an unpleasant job is quite functional, providing necessary mental escape from drudgery. But a really desperate functional daydream, oft the case with sexual fantasies, by the way, can for some people require a certain degree of plausibility in order to bring relief. Such a person, for example, couldn't long entertain the idea of being given money by leprechauns unless the person really believed in them, but could weave a nourishing daydream around the idea of finding money on the ground, especially if that had ever actually happened to the person before. Nor would such a daydreamer, if stuck on death row, waste much psychic energy on fantasies about leprechauns or acts of God. Instead, all daydreams would perforce start with commutations of sentence or outright pardons, or at least stays of execution, right up to the very last minute. So picture a kid in junior high school who had to go home after school, but who was afraid to go home. A kid whose mother was neither insane nor sexually abusive, but was, nonetheless, so pissed off at him that the kid basically felt that he truly needed to never see her again. Let's say this kid really perceived that as the only happy resolution that was actually plausible. So he'd focus on this idea as a cheering daydream and a way to avoid panic while facing the gallows. And chances are his fantasy, in order to do any good, would have to get more and more plausible as the day wore on, vouchsafing neither leprechauns nor acts of God, eschewing all notions that his mother might simply run away from home, proceeding, in fact, logically and relentlessly to the point where cars were being smashed into by other vehicles after running stop signs on the way to some Amish place somewhere to buy food. And chances are that this murderously plausible fantasy would be going on non-stop in the head, even as the principal, grim herald of plausibility, trod toward the ambient shop class. Such plausible daydreaming could almost be viewed as a survival instinct of sorts, even if, as in this case, it left the daydreamer psychotic, especially if that psychosis led to introspection that could help others or expand the horizons of human self-knowledge. And most especially if the victim of psychosis really was dangerously psionic but was rendered harmless by said introspection. But this last would imply an instinct for racial survival, I guess, whether that idea is plausible or not. Come to think of it, though, it's odd how little plausibility there has to be regarding religious beliefs, basically glorified daydreams, even among sufferers of the plausibility syndrome. Perhaps religious conviction simply transcends rational thought. And so, how did the plausibility syndrome impact on St. Cloud? It screwed up his sex life, is mostly how. St. Cloud couldn't plausibly imagine women desiring him, and so was unable to initiate sexual encounters, or half the time to even go along with them if someone else started them, since he could never be sure of the other person's motives. In view of this, it's surprising just how much sex with women St. Cloud got to enjoy at times, particularly during his younger adulthood, when he asked fewer questions and was better able to weigh the concept of plausibility through having a poor understanding of it. Not that he didn't learn better with experience. In any case, St. Cloud spent most of the so-called sexual revolution alternating between totally promiscuous and almost mindless casual encounters with any woman who was interested and, on the other hand, 8-year bouts of celibacy in any outward sense when no female interest seemed strongly indicated. And of course, this was before the AIDS crisis became such an epidemic and raised the stakes so astronomically for everyone. Anyway, the worst effects of the plausibility syndrome eventually hit St. Cloud right where the fucker lived, in the realm of masturbation, the land of Onan, the autoerotic barbarian, lord of the hairy palm. Sexually speaking, masturbation was a first language to St. Cloud, no matter how interested he became in actual encounters with actual women. Though even his earliest masturbatory fantasies certainly tended to reflect that interest, and so did even the final, almost unrecognizable form of what he was doing, in a way. Plausibly speaking, in regard to those earliest exhibitionistic fantasies of his, St. Cloud had to give them up when they stopped working, about the time when his adolescent self realized that most women wouldn't be all that amazed watching his act and would rather be kind of disgusted. That last also brings us to a secondary influence on these matters, but one which, unlike the plausibility syndrome, was self-imposed. At some point, St. Cloud had become fairly sympathetic to feminist ideas and to the struggles for equality of women in general, and had thus, at great length, developed a serious anti-rape credo. Hence, his sexual fantasies, though theoretically the last bastion of pure free thought, had to be purged of anything but mutually voluntary activity, which could get to be a downright complex problem in mental storytelling for someone who couldn't even imagine a woman wanting him to begin with, not even a woman he was actually in bed with at the time. So let's say the poor jerk was alone and potentially horny enough to want to whap the old putt. Where to begin? First, he'd have to imagine a woman actually wanting to fuck with him, as in okay, she has really bad taste, and, or, okay, I win the lottery, and, or, okay, her mind snaps, and, or, whatever. Given his own romantic bent, all this would leapfrog in his mind through various plausible social hoops and eventually even lead to marriage while he tried to get himself worked up. But by the time it would actually lead to sex, the poor slob would finally be bored to sleep, which is where pornography comes in handy. It's there. The sex is happening already. You don't have to think much about it if it arouses you. You only have to follow through. Of course, many feminists claim that pornography per se is tantamount to rape, in which case just plain old rape fantasies on St. Cloud's part would be a lesser evil, I guess. The only perfect solution at that point would be a prefrontal lobotomy for the old St. Cloudster, or simple euthanasia, perhaps. But St. Cloud would have to take issue with such an extreme view of pornography, if only for the sake of freedom of expression, compared to the loss of which, in general, pornography itself is a lesser evil. And even St. Cloud would acknowledge the porn industry to be a pretty dirty business in its exploitative aspects, though still postulating that it would be even worse if it were made illegal by losing whatever facade of regulation protective toward human rights that it has under the law. Thus, like neo-Nazism, fundamentalist Islamic sexism, and anti-Semitism, and other malignant expressions, St. Cloud regarded pornography as the price of free speech, and thus as a necessary evil for society, let alone for his own pathetic purposes. Nor can one forget about St. Cloud's own early knowledge of exhibitionism as a valid sexual motive for some people, though a minor point, perhaps. He couldn't help factoring that into the equation. For my part, I'm almost amused when some right-wing, self-serving political asshole brings Ted Bundy back from the grave to denounce pornography as the cause of the Bundy serial killing spree. See the Congressional Record for September 28, 1989, the version from our universe. That death row interview with an anti-pornography Christian radio broadcaster was Bundy's last vicious act of right-wing political mind rape. And it's almost stupefying to think of intelligent, thoughtful, well-intentioned people, in addition to right-wing zealots and demagogues, actually being able to take Bundy's word for anything. In the case of anti-pornography feminists, for example, Bundy's expert testimony on the subject would make for a case of very strange bedfellows indeed. The right-wing fundamentalist Christians seem right at home, in my mind, with such a ludicrous example of hypocrisy from such a fucking monster. In that interview, after all, it was claimed that Bundy had resolved his relationship with God or something So, assuming that Bondi and the women he preyed upon and murdered were all Christians, then they're all frolicking merrily together in the Christian heaven right now. Sounds like a damned jolly place, doesn't it? But anyway, if St. Cloud thought about women being forced into the porn industry, even economically, the stuff wouldn't work for him then, of course, and so, of course, he seldom thought about it. Call him a hypocrite, if necessary, but at least he wasn't a serial killer or a right-wing Christian bigot. Or at least he didn't know that he was sort of a serial killer in the psionic sense. He'd never heard of psionic matricide and didn't believe in paranormal abilities consciously, and so had failed to work that scenario out in his head so far. So there he was, anyway, collecting porn from an early age and gradually noticing that it was women's asses that most consistently aroused him. Or in this case, okay, pictures of their asses, but come on already. And he also became fixated, eventually, upon any account of sodomy that involved women, but only between nominally consenting adults, of course, because such accounts gradually persuaded him, after dozens of tepid heterosexual missionary encounters, that heterosexual sodomy was not only plausible, but was, in fact, the one thing that he most desperately wanted to do in bed. And the why of it is lost in speculation. But any theory has to take into account the fact, as stated by him, that he actually wound up reverencing his partners during such acts and regarding them literally as godlike in some way. Because St. Cloud did, of course, eventually find a way to try it, and he immediately liked it so much compared to normal or ordinary heterosexual activities, that said activities eventually became mere foreplay to him, once it transpired that only sodomy with women could get him off anymore, that is. But even that coin had two sides, of course, because it was only after St. Cloud began seeing female rectums as erogenous zones that he could start to view his own, at least nominally, virgin asshole as something that might respond to sex. This was because the idea of women liking it allowed St. Cloud to remove it from what he perceived in relation to his own behavior as the ghetto of homosexual so-called perversions, and to somehow see it as normal. At the risk of digressing far afield, it may be advisable to comment briefly on these last statements, and particularly on my parenthetical remarks. Some readers might get the idea from what I've said about St. Cloud's attitudes, that he was what is now called homophobic. And this would be literally true if you define that to mean afraid of men. But then St. Cloud was afraid of everybody, hence his fierce reclusiveness. And he was particularly afraid of men in general. He had, after all, grown up during a period when men still acted like a bunch of brutal, contentious, dominating pricks, and, as an outsider, had suffered much at their hands. nor have things changed that much out there among men, as near as I can see. Ironically, St. Cloud's lesser fear of women may have had to do with the death of his mother, which, I should now admit, paralleled the death of my own mother in every respect but one, that he wasn't consciously aware of any guilt for that on his own part. Still, it was his father who walked away from the debris, and young St. Cloud may have harbored the kind of subconscious guilt feelings that any kid might have gone through. Be that as it may, the fact remains that he feared men instinctively as men, while he only feared women as people, though also fearing rejection at their hands and so on. But St. Cloud feared men the way one might fear a mad dog. Lately, of course, the term homophobia has come to mean fear, hatred, and prejudice toward gay people of either sex. And by the time in his life that I'm talking about, St. Cloud was relatively free of this attitude. If anything, he was more comfortable around such people than he was around their enemies. But it would also be erroneous to suppose that his fear of men had nothing to do with sex. First of all, St. Cloud may have been raped by other males as a child. If so, he'd occluded it beyond the point of even admitting the possibility to himself. In any case, it never came up in his writing, though it seems to me as if it would explain some of his subsequent behavior. See if you can guess what I mean in the pages to come. But St. Cloud did admit that his earliest sexual encounters that he could remember were with other males and were so uniformly disastrous for him as to sour him for life against the thought of indulging in gay relationships. And his mother comes into the picture here too, having caught him at this on at least one occasion. Whatever she said or did at that time must have left a strong impression. But it was only very furtively that he could even allude to the event. I bring up this last point for whatever relevance it may have. St. Cloud had tasted cock and hadn't particularly liked it, but had then been negatively reinforced about it to boot, following which the author of said conditioning had died and effectively closed the subject for all time, leaving St. Cloud to deal with whatever twisted subconscious guilt feelings he had. Maybe things would have been different if he and his mother had been allowed to fight this out over the years. Or maybe not. It's easy to play amateur psychologist about this kind of crap, but the results remain inconclusive. Still, it can't possibly escape anyone's notice that St. Cloud's sexual inclinations would have made him gay if only he'd been attracted toward men instead of women. In fact, the poor bastard came to see gay men as being more normal than he was, suspecting that his own sexual orientation had been rerouted somewhere along the line. Be any of that as it may, the fact remains that he wasn't gay in any conventional sense of the word, and had no interest in any male bodies other than his own. And furthermore, though he didn't care what other males did, he had a really strong taboo, for whatever reason, against any gay sexual activity on his own part, but that didn't in any way diminish his own slowly growing anal sensitivity. Go figure, right? And so there he'd be, anyway, pumping his prick and looking at pictures of some woman with their southern cheeks spread wide, frantically beating his knee, with his eye frantically glued to their tempting, inviting little shitholes, imagining that they actually wanted something shoved in there. And before you know it, he was masturbating with both hands, shoving his own fingers up his own ass. Not in any homosexual way, of course, because, hell, a woman could as easily stick her fingers up him, right? At first, simply to convince himself that a woman, or anyone, could plausibly endure such an intrusion, let alone enjoy it. And after a while, he even came to enjoy it himself, which naturally helped to break down some of his inhibitions on the subject. Before long, St. Cloud graduated to fucking himself with erection-sized dildos and vibrators for greater verisimilitude, and maintained that not even this was homosexual, and that such prosthetic penises were exactly what a woman would fuck him with if she didn't want to wind up with shitty fingers. He also seemed to be overlooking, among other things, a seeming trend toward paraphilia here, though his rationale about women with dildos seemed, in fact, to handily negate this angle. Eventually, St. Cloud took to soaking the artificial organs of penetration in piping hot water before adding Vaseline to them and cramming them up his ass to better simulate the hypothetical woman's actual experience, especially if he was doing this in winter time. He also graduated to looking at hardcore butt-fucking porn. Photos of women getting sodomized, ass-fucked, and cornholed, which led to him nicknaming this stuff corn porn. And of course, for it to be any good for him, the models had to be at least nominally past the age of consent and engaging in said acts on a nominally consensual basis. Naturally, the staunchly heterosexual St. Cloud ignored the men in these photos, virtually occluding them, in fact. It was strictly the women that he was interested in, the way their asses looked, stuffed with occlusively neutralized cock, and the way their faces looked while their rectums were being massaged from within. Some of them smiled fetchingly, and some of them grimaced almost agonizedly, though still nominally on a consensual basis. And most of them had some kind of artificial blush on their faces that was, regardless of its authenticity, wildly erotic to St. Cloud, who imagined blushing that way himself, even while liking what was going on. Or even, at least in his case, because of liking what was going on. In some pictures, the woman's anus even seemed to be blushing. Regardless of the pallidity of her usually fat ass cheeks, being stretched plumply apart, and it was, somehow, partly such semblance of mild, instinctive shame or embarrassment that St. Cloud rocked to in his researches as he studied these pictures and screwed his own ass and tried to summon up a sense of shame about it to further titillate himself with. In fact, his favorite corn porn specimens usually involved the most undignified and vulnerable looking postures he could find, usually either featuring the woman that he found most attractive, the women that he found most attractive, or the ones so vaguely unattractive to him that he felt sort of sorry for them and somehow identified the more strongly with them. And this, of course, is at the very heart of St. Cloudism, this strong sense of identification with one's object of desire through some common denominator, almost a form of pseudo-telepathy. So any man can get himself butt-fucked by a woman, for instance, but only the true blue, die-hard St. Cloudist would be doing it in order to imagine being a woman, presumably a woman being artificially cornholed by another woman, I guess. And to really understand this kind of identification, one has to stipulate two things. One, that St. Cloud actually enjoyed being male and had no interest in surgically changing his sex, wanting rather to know what might be happening in a real woman's mind at any given time, if only at this one specific time, and two, that St. Cloud, who had been raised almost exclusively among males and who regarded females, his mother aside, as being mysteriously and exotically alien in essence, actually worshipped women in some strange way, having even come to view his post-Christian concept of God as being more female than otherwise. And this strange form of quasi-worship, not quite the same thing as putting women on pedestals, by the way, though the differences would be pretty abstract and hard to explain, is at the dead center of the very heart of St. Cloudism. Because St. Cloudism turns out to be essentially a form of religious communion in which St. Cloud, for example, jerking off with a fake prick up his asshole, tried to imagine being that woman in the picture, squatting on a meat spike, as well as trying to imagine fucking and being fucked by that woman, until he became one with his object of worship in his mind, or until he just came, whichever came first. And this, of course, implies that St. Cloud, in some way, thought that he was trying to fuck God, or to briefly somehow become God, and thence to fuck himself, which, of course, by his standards and in his situation, he most certainly was. So, I guess it's just a damned good thing that he tried to keep matters so consensual. Or maybe St. Cloud was just a realist who figured that God was shoving it up our butts most of the time anyway, so why not sublimate the whole thing into some kind of a mutually viable relationship. In any case, St. Cloud didn't truly realize the depths of his sexual identification until he found himself training his own nipples to get hard when he touched them, while also fantasizing about female ejaculation and somehow connecting that to his own unsuccessful experimental attempts to achieve some kind of rectal orgasm without otherwise touching himself at all. But of course, by that time, it was too late to stop. So anyway, by these quasi-religious tokens, those life drawings or figure studies derived from his favorite sleazy corn porn photos can be regarded as the virtual equivalent of iconic crucifix images to a Christian. Good job Jesus didn't get himself impaled or just plain gang raped to death, isn't it? Meanwhile, as long as we're studying St. Cloud's religious peculiarities, let's get on back to the great treasonal crisis and see what kind of impact that might have been having on his odd devotions. I believe I mentioned, however long ago, about the treasonal itself having become a kind of sacramental host for our daffy supplicant. And I guess, in a way, the corn porn was as well. But please understand that the basic St. Cloudist sex attitudes and practices evolved long before he ever even tried his first hit of treasonal. The drug merely enhanced his experience. So you can't exactly blame all this on drugs, though you probably will anyway. What the drug actually did after he'd been on it for about 48 hours at any given time was to open up a strange and little used part of his mind, or of his personality, if that's something different, and to make him feel even closer to his God by making him talk to himself as if God was actually listening in on the phone or even sitting right there in the room. This apart from the auto-sodomistic communion rituals, which could happen as often as 7 or 8 times during a given treasonal binge, in addition to more conventional forms of masturbation. In effect, he established a warm relationship with a part of himself which seemed, unlike Smiley et al., only to be there on treasonal, or, at the very least, only to be there after 48 hours or so of intensive introspection or meditation. What is prayer? And so, in effect, when they outlawed treasonal, they cut St. Cloud off from a part of his relationship with God, as that part of his mind slammed shut forever. In essence, they banned part of his religion. But of course, that only matters if you try to take people's communion wine and or dildo-shaped plastic Jesuses and Marys away from them. God damn you all, anyway. And so the hell with it, anyway. Why try to explain a guy like St. Cloud to a bunch of assholes who only believe in whatever it says on TV or through some other officially approved outlet? But here I am, in any case, trying to type up St. Cloud's memoirs in the hope, on his part, that they'll make more sense that way, or at least that they'll seem more official that way. And it occurs to me that I should give St. Cloud a chance to represent himself by putting him on the witness stand, as it were, which were best accomplished by simply printing some of his gibberish verbatim, as opposed to filtering it through the jaundiced eye and other biased narrative perceptions and inclinations of what is called in literary circles the omniscient observer, me. And so here it is, hot off the computer, the latest installment of St. Cloud's self-indulgent balderdash, covering an episode which occurred a week or two before the perceptual end of the treasonal age, just a few days after he started working on his novel. Chapter 22. And it was sort of thanks to Garm, in a low-key sort of way, of course, that I continued writing. Some 200 motels later, and after Joyce Carol's great martyrdom, that is. But before I get too doggone literary here, I'd better try to explain the situation so that you, gentle reader, will have a fighting chance to understand. Desmond Garm was there, of course, and I even saw his little dog Fenris that night, some 2 days into a major treasonal run, days which I'd spent wondering if I should try to finish Labyrinth or just tear the fucker up. Maybe tear the pictures up as well, when I couldn't help laughingly remembering Lovecraft's literary comment on freedom of expression in the arts. "See here, Rogers, this won't do. There are limits, you know. It's a great piece of work and all that, but it isn't good for you. Better not see it anymore. Let Ora Bona break it up and try to forget about it. And let me tear this beastly picture up, too." That was from The Horror in the Museum, 1932, written in collaboration by H.P. Lovecraft and his ghostwriting client, Hazel Held, first published in Weird Tales and lately republished by Arkham House. In synopsis, a connoisseur of weird and morbid art is repulsed by a photo of the Cthulhuvian monster Ran Tegoth, supposedly taken from a wax model, created by the mad sculptor Rogers and his reluctant assistant, the inscrutable Ora Bona. Lovecraft, of course, more or less supported free speech in reality, or at least he became disenchanted with fascism and Nazism for not including it in their respective New World orders. Among other things, despite his own rabid nativism, H.P.L. was appalled by Hitler's vicious persecution of Jews, for instance, even before the war. And Lovecraft, the ghost writer, was seemingly willing to say even ridiculous things, or to help others say them, just so long as he got paid his trivial wages. His most consistent ghosting client, for example, was a sort of evangelical self-help loudmouth of some kind named David Van Bush, whom Lovecraft privately called a literary damned fool. I've always pictured this guy as looking and sounding a lot like Frederick March playing the W.J. Bryan surrogate in the classic Scopes monkey trial film, Inherit the Wind. Bush wrote books with titles like Grit and Gumption, circa 1922, and his poems said things like, just boost her up and make her go, and other homilies of a supposedly inspirational nature. Lovecraft, of course, was paid to edit and otherwise ghostwrite this pompous twaddle, and from what I've seen of the stuff, HPL couldn't have tossed out too much of the ludicrous tripe involved and still have retained any kind of statement at all. It kind of makes one appreciate the comment by the magazine Fantasy and Science Fiction executive editor Avram Davidson in 1963 that Lovecraft earned his wretched minuscule income by revising, quote, the crappy manuscripts of writers whose complete illiteracy would have been a boon to all mankind, unquote. So there I was, wired to the gills on treasonal after 2 days of work on my figure studies, with Labyrinth held out as a carrot of sorts. And yet, whenever I thought of either the story novel or the drawings, it was being written to be illustrated by, a voice in my mind would kind of say quite seriously, in a low-key sort of way, see here, St. Cloud, this won't do. There are limits, you know. It's a great piece of work and all that, but it isn't good for you. Better just shove it up your ass, if you don't have the grit and gumption to just boost her up and make her go. And for God's sake, break up whatever this beastly Orabona crap is as well, before some sarcastic magazine editor starts making fun of you as if your complete illiteracy would have been a boon to all mankind. But then another voice, that low-key treasonal voice, which always seemed to come on after a couple of days awake, came on and said this, look, St. Cloud, you're taking it all too seriously. Who the hell cares whether you finish Labyrinth or not? But why not try anyway, if only in a low-key fashion? Or even don't try, who cares? After all, what can you expect from a novel which started out as a long poem, meant only to give a bunch of dirty pictures something to illustrate? Sure, the first few pages really suck. How could they not? So change them if you want to, or just plain fuck them. What's the difference? So far, it's only some 20-odd manuscript pages to throw away. And the pictures? They'll be worth something, maybe, as original drawings someday, pornographic or not, with or without a novel to explain them. So you can finish those puppies regardless. But hell, as long as you're tossing Labyrinth out, why not finish the outline of what your novel would have been like? That would be a pretty low-key operation, and wouldn't give you that much more to have to throw away, and your sense of honor would at least be satisfied, and who knows? Why, I can remember, no way. I can't remember. Forget it. Note, treasonal aphasia strikes again. We are experiencing technical difficulties. The trouble is not in your set. Please stand by. But even so, the voice had inspired me to pick up a pencil and scrap paper, the single easiest and least irrevocable form of artwork that I know of. Half an hour later, I had the entire outline down on odd scraps of paper and was exalting. Compared to nothing, it looked pretty good in a low-key, skeletal kind of way. I'd been wanting to listen to the tape Des Garm had recently given me of 200 motels since I'd gotten out of bed 2 days ago. But I'd been putting it off for the entire time, and now I thought I'd finish the outline and listen to the tape as a treat. If only I didn't have to eat before dropping any more trees and all. And then, with only the last brief paragraph to go on, those notes, who should show up but Desmond Garm himself? And he rented a videotape of 200 motels and was inviting me over for dinner and to watch the movie. Well now, of course the timing here was pretty snazzy. It almost seemed as if the universe was rewarding my 2-day-long struggle with that half-hour outline, the easiest form of writing that there is. Moreover, Zappa's film was only an acid-drenched pseudo-memory from years gone by, but my seeing it had immediately preceded my starting the first important painting of my career years ago, so this all seemed kind of auspicious. Best of all, I could eat behind my own back, so to speak, while Garm and I watched the flick, and then be ready to take as much Treasonal as I wanted, following which, in a few hours, I could start writing again in earnest. Desmond Garm was a fellow artist with whom I shared an interest not only in Zappa, but in other 60s cultural manifestations as well, chief among them being underground comics, a veritable bastion of freedom of expression, by the way. Garm and I often joked about Frank Zappa's back door being open too long, and about the underground cartoonists not even having a back door to begin with. Such jokes were based on a funny thing that had happened the previous Xmas. During a so far low-key sort of season, which I nevertheless insisted on thinking of as the thimble winter, feeling, I guess, that it presaged some Treasonal crazed Ragnarok of my own. But be that as it may, it seems that I answered my door at about 5:30 p.m. on Xmas Eve, and it was Des Garm out there. "Come in," I cried, trying to sound like Tiny Tim and checking my mail while I was at it. And the funniest thing about all this was the mail. Des had brought me a seasonal gift, William Burroughs's Cities of the Red Night, which Garm knew I'd been wanting to read for years. So things might have been reasonably festive, except for that mail. Technically, it wasn't even my mail. This Xmas Eve epistle had been written to some woman I'd never heard of, who had, evidently at random, chosen to have her mail forwarded to my address. The letter turned out to be a dolefully itemized account of damages written by her previous landlord, a lugubrious repair bill in excess of $1,150, already and ominously including both an excess water bill resulting from unauthorized occupants, unknown at the date hereof, and most absurdly ominous of all, a gas bill resulting from leaving back door wide open, unknown at the date hereof. talk about the fear of the unknown. The funniest part was the penultimate paragraph in which it was regretted that the cost of such repairs far exceeds the $82 security deposit, so that it is necessary to retain the deposit to be applied to repairs, let alone the final crisp. Your cooperation in this matter would be appreciated. Well now, far exceeds indeed. Appreciated my foot. The previous tenant sounds like some kind of shogun squirrel, as another of my pals might have put it. I didn't know what to do with the letter, so I just kept it in case that previous authorized occupant ever showed up for her mail, and as an Xmas Eve souvenir, and as a reminder that landlords have feelings too, you know? And so there were ominous, semi-tragic, wide-open backdoor jests aplenty on this night, 8.5 months later, as I sizzled on a couple of days worth of trees and all, and watched Desmond's happy little dog Fenris frolic merrily about in their backyard. I sat with Des on their back porch, watching mine host barbecue marinated beef and other items into some really kick-ass kebabs. And then we snarfed said viands down while watching Zappa leave his back door open forever, and so widely that it wasn't any wonder so many discrepancies existed betwixt soundtrack and soundtrack album. I wondered what the posh British orchestra thought of being in a film like that, what Theodore Bickel thought, whether Flo and Eddie, aka Mark Volman and Howard Kalin, saw it as a come down from the Turtles, whether anyone save Zappa knew what a fucking masterpiece it was. It was like taking acid all over again, without the acid, except that I held my water this time. But my mind's back door was waving in the breeze and gloating about that finished outline for what I'd now decided was the novel awaiting me at home. I couldn't believe how fucking excited I was about that. But then I was toasted on trees and all. My brain was snapping and crackling. My mind was popping. Then too, Zappa was frying my mind without window pane this time, and it seemed so like encouragement. I wanted Labyrinth of Venereal Vestals to be sort of like 200 Motels, or a cross between that and Fellini's Satyricon. Of course, my outline was only the barest sketch of what I was trying to do, but a story of sorts was there. The ending had been kind of dicey for a while, but I'd sort of gotten atop it. Things got so ridiculous towards the end that I needed some kind of deus ex machina to straighten out all the loose ends. I thought of simply having all the characters spontaneously combust, but I just couldn't bring myself to do that. The problem had really stumped me for a while. But then I bethought myself of Lovecraft, whose Cthulhu mythos could, in a way, be regarded as one long deus ex machina, so I decided to rip him off for my ending. Actually, I chose a critter which Lovecraft had probably never even heard of, a great old one created, I believe, by some post-Lovecraftian mythos scribe, possibly Brian Lumley or Colin Wilson. Wilson seems the likelier candidate, having mentioned the being called Atlak Naka in his 1969 novel, The Philosopher's Stone, but only very briefly. At least Lumley wrote about the creature at length in a 1981 story from Weird Book 15, a story entitled Recognition, or maybe he wrote about its ghost. At any rate, Lumley's story summed up the book-banning, knowledge-fearing flavor of all Lovecraft's stuff by postulating that even knowing about these arcane matters can be deadly. Most of what I know about this entity, however, comes from the role-playing game tome Cthulhu Companion, published in 1983 by Chaosium Incorporated, written by Sandy Peterson. For my purposes, though, I'd had to change the being's gender, or at least to provide an alternate version of it, a decision which I can only hope that I will survive. If just knowing about this creature can be fatal, then what does one get for the hubris of actually fucking around with it? That is, at any rate, assuming that I even use this ending, which my typist, Goblin Hood's buddy, will probably think is trite and corny, and will probably think so sarcastically and volubly and at great length. Coming down a little here, more treason all seems in order. Desmond and I sat around yapping about Zappa's flick when it was over, while Fenris thumped his tail on the floor and listened approvingly. But I was really thinking about the Satyricon, not Fellini's version, but the original one by Petronius, usually thought to be Emperor Nero's Arbiter of Excellence, or whatever. I'd read the thing recently as research for the kind of story I was trying to write, and one thing had struck me. During the famous Feast of Trimalchio, the characters spoke of leaving during the feast to use the close stool, or crapper, I think. But nobody ever mentioned the celebrated vomitoriums, where Romans supposedly and oh so festively made room for the next course. Could that be just a myth? Say what you like, Petronius was actually there at the time. Anyway, I figured maybe I could provide an analogous record of my era by casting me, Smiley, both versions, and the dinosaur as updated versions of the vagabond scholars and thieves Encolpius, Asiltos, and Jatone. Or maybe I was just getting kind of grandiose there on treasonal. I only hoped that I wouldn't be needing to visit the vomitorium myself. Not from Desmond's great meal, but from certain effects that the treasonal had been having on me lately. Lately meaning for months now. Eventually Garm drove me home. I immediately hooked down some more treasonal, but I couldn't start writing again just yet. I had some unfinished business. I'd spent most of that afternoon reading a library book by Joyce Carol Oates, a story collection entitled Haunted Tales of the Grotesque, Dutton, 1994. Right after I'd finished it was when I'd managed to scribble out my novel's skeletal outline. So her book, too seemed kind of auspicious, like a good luck charm. But I'd skipped the last tale, having read it before in an anthology. This was called Martyrdom, and was one of the best stories that I'd ever read, let alone the best in her book. Anyway, I read it now for luck, and wound up wishing I could write like that. My outline started to seem silly. Then I listened to some music, including Zappa's 200 Motels, for which I wrote up a little synopsis of the flick just to keep the two straight in my head. I thought about my book. Morning came and I still hadn't done anything creative. I needed more trees and all, and so I had to eat. So I read another short story while I ate. This was from another library book, a horror anthology called Night Visions 5, edited by Douglas E. Winter, Dark Harvest, Inc., 1988. The story by Dan Simmons was entitled Vanni Fucci is Alive and Well and Living in Hell. I'd already read it once, 4 years ago. I wasn't looking for inspiration. It was a funny story and I just wanted to laugh. But it contained a fascinating idea. This idea gave me the germ of an idea about trying to use some kind of parallel world motif and labyrinth of venereal vestals. But I couldn't be sure of the validity of the short story's information. Fucci was a character from Dante's Inferno who claimed that Dante stuck him, a supposed thief, in the seventh bulgia of the eighth circle of hell for political reasons. Fucci also claimed that this hell was made real by the force of Dante's mind and by the power of everyone's belief in Dante's work. I'll let Fucci explain his own theory. Note, I don't have italics, nor does my typist, so I'm underlining the author's italics in this quote. Let me tell you about an experiment performed in 1982, said Vanni Fucci, at the University of Paris South. A group of quantum physicists, headed by Alain Aspect, tested the behavior of two photons flying in opposite directions from a light source. The test confirmed an underlying theory of quantum mechanics, namely that a measurement made on one photon has an instantaneous effect on the nature of another photon. Photons, gentlemen, traveling at the speed of light. Obviously, no information could be transmitted faster than the speed of light itself, but the act of defining the nature of one photon instantaneously changed the nature of the other photon. Fucci also maintained in the story that reality is shaped by the first great mind which focuses on measuring it. New concepts create new laws and the universe abides. Newton created universal gravity and the cosmos rearranged itself accordingly. Well, an interesting concept, to be sure, but reading over it, I'm not sure what it has to do with parallel worlds or how it got me thinking along those lines, nor do I understand the physics involved. And how do I know that Vanni Fucci, an alleged thief condemned to hell, is even telling the truth? Elaine Aspect certainly sounds suspiciously like a made-up name to me. Anyway, I did more trees and all, but I wanted my food to settle, so I started reading something short from a huge library omnibus called Modern Classics of Science Fiction, edited by Gardner Dozois, St. Martin's Press, 1991. Several hundred pages later, evening came again, and with it, despair. I still hadn't written anything. I had to eat again, and the whole project was seeming pretty stupid. After 3 days now, outline or no outline, I ate some food, despite my growing nausea. And then I ate some more trees and all, despite my growing exhaustion. And then that trees and all voice finally cajoled me into picking up a pencil and a piece of paper. The easiest part of my work, remember? After three stiff, uninspiring pages of prose, I finally let myself off the hook and sent myself off to bed, feeling like a fluttering, tattered veil lost in a graveyard for old rubbish. But I'd written 3 pages, and honor was served. I woke up after only a couple of hours, feeling even worse. I felt hollow, sick, and depressed, and my head ached monstrously to boot. I badly needed food, if only so I could take some pills for my headache, but the thought of eating almost turned my stomach. Anyway, the stars were still out, so I sat on my back porch for a while watching them and drinking coffee, and a funny thing happened in the backyard. The watchdog from next door had burrowed under the fence and was sleeping in my backyard. She woke up and noticed me sitting there immediately. She'd been watching me sit there for 4 or 5 years without much comment, so she knew exactly who I was. But she must have gotten confused about where she was or something. Maybe I just looked too much closer than usual. Well, she started to bark loudly enough, but not quite seriously, it seemed to me. She seemed to be barking things like, "Hey everyone, I'm a dog, and I like to bark. In fact, I'm supposed to bark. I don't really know if I'm supposed to bark at this guy or not, but by God, if I ever do know, or if he tries to pull something, damn it, I'll bark like hell then. You think this is loud? Wait till you hear me when I'm supposed to bark. Arrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrr just getting into crooning and yodeling like a cartoon coyote in the desert about how important it was to make as much noise as possible at a time like this. Other dogs were waking up and joining in. Watching her make this damned fool out of herself, I got to thinking about Garmin Fenris. Desmond had told me about having once gotten all canine type, territorial, and growling at Fenris about some regrettable infraction on the carpet, and had described how freaked out Fenris had been by the performance. Anyhow, once I got fed up with the howling, I finally spoke up in a quiet, normal sort of human growl. Shut the fuck up or get out of my yard. She leaped up and dived under the fence like a squished banana squirting out of its peel, back to the comfort and safety of her own turf. But now she seemed too embarrassed to do much barking and only growled half-heartedly instead. The gist seemed to be, of course, this little misunderstanding was nobody's fault. And I think we should just keep this regrettable little matter between ourselves, don't you? And even, you can't really blame someone for anything they say before that first cup of coffee in the morning, you know? She finally just shut up, which was good, because I had a lot of thinking to do and I needed to concentrate. Besides, I felt like warmed over hell and I was seeing weird horrors from the corners of my eyes, compared to which this dog was merely comic relief. Most of all, I didn't need to be listening to the ignorant whims and whams of a dog, because I was too busy looking at the stars and trying to pray. If the entity that I prayed to had a real name, I don't know what that name was. I was pretty sure, though, that its name wasn't Jesus. I just called the entity God because that's what it seemed to be. As an apostate Christian, of course, I couldn't help speculating from time to time whether any godlike entity other than Jesus might not best be called Satan. But I couldn't quite swallow the idea. I'd come to associate even the good guys of Christianity with incredible malevolence, let alone their devils. And my God didn't seem like that at all. Of course, if my God was in charge of this world, then it had been responsible for untold horror and suffering. The last two world wars, just for starters. Everything bad, in fact. Not to mention the whole fact of death. But none of that seemed personal. I felt that we were simply being left to our own devices about wars and stuff. God's tolerance of our evils didn't seem to involve any malice aforethought, nor did death itself. It just seemed to be a really weak point in human design. I could even see death as maybe being sort of good. After all, I was getting really tired of my pointless existence at the age of 42, particularly in a world like this. And I couldn't imagine immortality as being anything but an endless, boring, pointless, and probably painful hell, especially if it meant physical immortality around here, achieved somehow by humans, the better to torment one another, no doubt, at the sufferance of God. I actually saw God as like a child who was just now waking up. A little thoughtless, perhaps, and a lot cranky, waiting, no doubt, for that first cup of coffee in the morning. I didn't know how many people